Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantry.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, chase your destiny. By PremiumPlus-Sports.com, one of the best travel agencies in the business. By USA-SwimRun.com. If you haven't tried a swim run event, what the heck are you waiting for? Go to USA-SwimRun.com. Our Challenge Athletes Foundation. We just sent out 2,806 grants totaling $4.3 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, Mr. Andrew Starkiewicz, one of the premier triathletes on the planet, always first off the bike. I think he's been off the bike first over 50 times in his career. Andrew, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I've only at the Ironman distance level, I think I've only gotten 3 wins, but at the half Ironman, I got a couple more.
So the Iron branded type of distances, and with Rev 3 and some of that thrown in.
Yeah, I've won more races than I ever expected I would in the sport.
Well, especially because so when I look back at 2005, you're an age grouper back then, and still you're you've got a full-time gig. You're an engineer from Purdue. But that year, 05, first overall age grouper in Chicago at the Olympic distance, Wildflower Olympic distance, Memphis Olympic distance. At that point, you're probably thinking, okay, it is time to go pro.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I always tell young kids, that are aspiring to go pro is win everything you want as an age grouper and know what that feeling is of winning a big race. Because once you go pro, you never get it again. You never know if you'll get it again. And if you go pro and then going back to race, and if you don't make it as a pro and go back to racing age grouper, it's just not going to feel the same.
No, and never. And what was the big, was there a surprise for you? Because a lot of times people do really well as an age grouper, and they don't quite understand it's a little different game as a pro. But the way you race, that you go off the front, did your racing change going from age group to pro?
You know, what changed was, when I was an age grouper, I was, there was very few of us that swam at the level I did.
Right.
And so all of a sudden when I'm pro, I'm used to, 200 or 300 yards of banging elbows and then having some open water. And all of a sudden it's, either A, you're getting dropped, or B, you're wrestling for every inch the entire swim.
Right, yeah, there's people with you either hitting your feet or you're trying to stay on feet, so it's a lot more combative.
It's a lot more, and the thing is, the nice part about professionals is, for the most part, there are a few guys that are a little grabby, but for the most part, everybody's darn respectful of each other, and, there's so many of us that we race the same races over and over and over, and we know, if you clock somebody in the swim, you know who it is. And they come up to you after the race, or you go up to them after the race and was like, sorry about that. I mean that because, we race so often, and most of us swim side by side week after week after week, or month after month, year after year, it's become.
So you're working at Caterpillar. You got a real job. You're here again, mechanical engineer. You're, I'm sure, making good dollars. Making the decision in 09 to leave Caterpillar and go full time, was that scary?
Yeah. Anytime you have a huge change in life, it's scary. Just looking back at the stats that I'd had through 2008 and then into the beginning of 2009, I don't know what I was doing making that decision. I really didn't have any, paying contracts. I had a couple of small contracts with very small bonuses. And I was nickel and diming the way through the sport, finishing, at the tail end of the money. And I think in 2008, I finished, 7 or 8 races. And I think my biggest paying race, I finished 7 or 8 races in the money. And I think my biggest paying race was $2,000.
Hey, that's good.
And, you do. And then to make that jump,
it was big. Now, was there a point where was the bike, obviously you're a front pack swim guy, but was a bike always that weapon for you, or is that something that evolved?
It's always been, ever since I've gotten into the sport, it's always been kind of my weapon. I've always enjoyed growing up riding the bike.
Yeah.
And I never did it competitively at all. And as I got into triathlon and in college, I also raced some cycling. And then in 2006, when I was my first year pro in triathlon, and I was also racing Cat 1-2-3 in cycling, I kind of looked at it, and I got to make a decision. I got to do one or the other, because as much as the training is somewhat similar for the bike, it's very different. And I kind of looked at it, and in order to be successful in cycling, it was going to be almost impossible to maintain a full-time job. So I made the decision to discontinue my career in cycling and go and focus more on triathlon. And it paid immediate dividends in the spring of 2007. I definitely had a jump in performance doing more focused training towards triathlon and less towards road races and crits.
Yeah, 2007, your first pro podium, right? Memphis in May, second to Chris McCormick, two-time Ironman champion. And by 2011... you'd won at Olympic distance races, half, full. Did you feel at that point which was better for you? And there was a point there too where you had the Olympic distance racing, and with the Lifetime Series and a lot of that stuff started to go away a little bit. There was less opportunity at the Olympic distance than there was at half and 70.3 and Rev 3 and those type of events and full.
Yeah, I got kind of tipped off by a couple people in the industry that just pretty much alluded to the fact that the Olympic distance bubble is going to pop.
Yeah.
That Lifetime and 5150 was, that was the most unfortunate thing that's ever happened to the sport because it took away a lot of great races with a lot of history.
I agree.
But I got tipped off at the 5150 and that the Lifetime bubble was about to pop, and Toyota and all the other sponsors were going to pull out of the Lifetime series. And so I found that out in I think late in 2009, and that's when I kind of changed my training to really focus on the half and full distance in 10 and 11. I was Olympic distance and half Ironman athlete through up till that point, but 2010 was my first over distance triathlon where I did Abu Dhabi, and then 2011, I think, was my first over distance triathlon where I did Abu Dhabi, and then I did Rev 3 Cedar Point later that year. Both of them turned out, both of them I raced really well. I really surprised myself because I didn't really focus on either of those races. I kind of just, took the training that I had for the half distance and slowed it down a little bit and had some success.
Well, and then, first pro win, Westchester Tri 2009, first off the bike, 70.3 world, same year. So you're starting to build a reputation at that point. 2011, you win the Rev 3 series. And then 2013, first American under 8 hours at Ironman Florida. That's pretty impressive. Yeah.
That was one of those that, it was 2012 when I won Ironman Florida.
Yep.
All of a sudden, there's a couple people, Dan Enfield, one of them, was contacting me and said, that was at that point, it was the third fastest or second fastest ever Ironman.
For an American. Yeah.
Yeah, and I went in 8:06 at Ironman Florida that year. And, the next year, 2013, I had a truly disappointing race at Kona due to, the classic, there was quite a few of us that got sick on the perform because, Power Bar was unable to supply the quantity of perform needed for the race, and they shipped it in from all over the world, and there was a bad batch in there, too.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, Carolyn Steffen, myself, Dirk Bockel. There was about 10 pros that just got, I mean, Bevan Doherty was one of them, where you just see us, just, we just got horrifically sick on it. And, you know, everybody said there was nothing wrong with it, but magically the next year Gatorade was a sponsor.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Earlier, Metrex had been a sponsor for 1 year. And same type of thing. That was the year that Chris Lee collapsed 50 yards from the finish and ended up losing some intestines. And that was, yeah, that was a little bit of an issue. So, and again, I think that was the year you really didn't get to train on that product, right? They didn't have it available. Or did they?
They didn't have the liquid. They had the powder, but the powder was a completely different molecular base than the liquid drink.
Wow. And that was which year? Was that 12?
13.
13.
Lucky 13.
Yeah. And so then you, which year were you first off the bike in Kona?
That was 13.
That was 13. Okay.
Yeah.
And
I wasn't sweating when I came off the bike, which
that's
is
a problem.
Bad sign when you have to run a marathon.
Oh, my God.
Because I'd been throwing up for 2 hours, through 2.5 hours on the bike. From the one-hour mark to the three-hour mark, I just kept throwing up. I couldn't keep anything down, and I was trying everything. I couldn't drink a single thing, and the only thing... late in the bike, I started being able to sip on some Coke.
Right.
And that was the only thing the rest of the race I could keep small sips of water and Coke down. And that was it. I couldn't, gels I would throw up. It was, I don't know how I finished that day. I don't know how I finished it as well as I did, but I made it.
Wow. That's so when you look at Kona, because right now you're going back to Kona, but before we get into that, when you get hit by a truck, right? And at that point, you broke your back, road rash everywhere. There was a chance you might not race again, but who knew what was going to happen to you physically? Take me through all the injuries you dealt with from the truck that hit you.
I have multiple thoracic fractures. I had a broken lower leg. Broken lower left leg. I had the tendon that connects your big toe was hanging out of my leg. I had a severe concussion, and I still battle with TBI and PTSD from that.
Sure.
And I just had a lot of road rash, but yeah, I mean. In a weird way, it's lucky, you know. I mean, I don't look at Ford pickup trucks the same way because, you know, to think that I got dragged underneath one and, you know, from the front to the back and out the back, it was, you know, it's not much clearance in there. And, I mean, it's, you know, just the quantity of road rash, and it's not like it's one spot. I mean, I have road rash all the way around the circumference of my kneecaps you know, just getting rolled and everything. But, you know, it happened. It was a challenge. And, I mean, they didn't know if I'd walk again. And I started doing that relatively quickly. And then every day it's doing what is possible.
So, and at the same time, you're a dad. You've got your little girl. And then, I mean, during this process of trying to recover, you become a dad again, right, to little Xander. And he had complications right away?
He had complications, and then so they kept him in the NICU, and then they sent him home after a week, and it was 4 or 5 days later. My wife and I were watching TV, and she had just finished breastfeeding him, and he turned, he stopped breathing and turned blue. And here I am, I'm in a back brace, and you know, I'm in a boot with a broken leg, it's all splinted up. And next thing I know, I'm giving him CPR on the couch, on the edge of the couch. And I don't even know.
Yeah, what was it? What was the diagnosis? What did they figure out?
I mean, after it took him about 10 weeks to figure out exactly what it was. It turns out that he was he is having seizures, and his instead of having like a traditional grand mal seizure, his seizures were the type in which he would stop breathing. And so there were multiple times actually that he came home two or three different times and then had another set of seizures because they didn't know what it was. I mean, he'd have one and then it'd go a week and or two in the hospital, and they'd run all the tests and everything would come back fine, and they'd send him home, and then he'd have, you know, they all of a sudden he'd stop breathing again. And I mean, the local fire department knew exactly every time. They knew their way around our house. They knew our dog's names. It's kind of bad when the fire department knows your dog's names.
Yeah, that's not a good thing.
I had to give him, personally, I gave him CPR twice.
Wow.
And, but he's, you know, they finally figured out what exactly what it was. And, he's been on epileptic drugs ever since. And he's been seizure-free since, 20 months ago.
So 1 year after the crash in 2017, you win 70.3 Steelhead, and then you win...
Almost 1 year to the date.
Wow.
It was 1 year and 4 days, or 1 year and 5 days.
That has to be the most special win, to basically overcome what you overcame.
It was up until that point, that was the most special win. That was indescribable. It was one of those days. I mean, I led that race wire to wire.
Yep.
And it was, that was a special day. And it was one of those days where you kind of feel like you had the wind at your back the whole entire day.
Hmm.
No other way to describe it. It was my day.
Yeah. And then did you win Ironman Louisville that same summer?
Yep.
Wire to
wire at Ironman Louisville.
Wow.
You know, that same weekend as Kona, I think I've won the same weekend as Kona, I think three or four different times. So I just now actually got to win the race when it's at Kona.
Exactly. So speaking of that, when I look at it's funny, when I watched what was happening last year in Kona with Cam Wirth and Lionel Sanders and Sebastian Kienle coming out of the water like 7 minutes back, making up 7 minutes in 60K, I'm sitting there going, imagine if Starkey was in that group and you had the four of those guys. Now, I'd assume that you'd swim a little, you'd be in front of those three. Or maybe Cam Wirth. Cam Wirth is sort of in between, I think, the two of those guys in terms of their swimming. But when you look at Kona this year, how do you play it out? How does it play out in your mind?
I'm actually hoping that with a few more of the guys that are super strong swimmers, I hope they break that 25, 30-guy pack in half. And I hope we have, you know, just a couple of two smaller groups there are three groups of 15. You have that. I hope that first group just breaks in half, and you get a group around 49 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and then a group around 51 minutes, and then you have that traditional group that has Kienle and Wirth and Lionel around 55 minutes.
And so in between, then you got Jan and those guys in that in between pack, the 51 minute group.
Jan is.
Oh man, that could be 49 too.
I think Jan's a 49 guy.
Yeah,
I mean he's. The thing is it's one of those where I think a lot of guys are going to do what Javi does. And if Javi goes, I think a lot of guys are going to try to chase him.
So even though Javi hasn't done that race before, people you think are going to key off of Javi?
He's a world champion.
Yeah. Always.
Multiple times. He's probably one of the best. He's probably one of the best triathletes that's ever
in
walked the
history.
Circle.
No question about it. No question about it. Yeah. And heat doesn't bother him in the least. He's not not one of those guys where the heat's an issue.
Believe me, I raced him in Panama, and I was the 70.3 in Panama years back. And I mean, I was literally walking in aid stations in a half Ironman because it was so hot, and I was just getting all the fluid I could, all the salts I could, everything I could. And he's going through aid stations, just blowing them off.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is like mile 7 or mile 6 when he passed me, and I'm drinking everything I can, and he comes running right by and like tipping aid stations. And I'm like, that's just not right.
No. Well, look what he did last year at 70.3 Worlds in Chattanooga. You know, Ben Canute did everything right. And I think he ran like 116 off the bike and had, what, a five-minute lead or something. And Javi ran 110. And Chattanooga's not that's not a flat course. He was sort of forced to run a 110. And so he ran a 110 to win that race.
Right.
So, yeah, the guy is just unbelievably talented. So you add Javi to the mix with Patrick Lange, with Jan Frodeno, plus, obviously, all the other players who are going to be there, who, like we just mentioned, with Sebastian Kienle and Lionel and Cam Wurf. The bike could be, the bike could really be a race, right, where guys are surging and trying to get away and trying to have some sort of a gap before the run.
Yeah, every year it kind of plays out very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Where when it's cool outside, everybody is on the limit.
Right.
And then it just kind of, as the race goes on, it kind of plays to who's handled the heat best, who's got their nutrition spot on. I mean, that's really one of the biggest things at Kona that a lot of people don't realize is as much as it is about the race. It's so hot that you got to be perfect on your nutrition plan because if you're not totally spot on, it goes real sideways real quick.
I remember for years, Chris McCormick struggled with the heat over there. And we were down at Auburn University, and he was trying different uniform fabrics from Under Armour to try to see what works best, because the heat obviously is a big issue, especially as a bigger guy. You're a bigger guy. And you were just doing some stuff with Polar to work on heat at the Corey Stringer Institute at UConn. Now, what did you learn from that?
That racing at Ironman Hawaii is a death march for me. There's to do what I want to do and what I'm training to do. It's going to require me to be surgical precision on my nutrition plan because I recorded the highest ever sweat rate on the bike and run that they have ever recorded.
Oh my God! Really?
Yes. I mean, on the run at Ironman conditions at Hawaii, I was sweating 4 liters an hour.
4 liters an hour? How do you replace that? That's a lot.
And that's the thing is your body. Most people's body only absorbs 1.2 to 1.4 liters an hour. My body, just through years of training and just being blessed with a good gut, I can get about 1.7 liters an hour that I absorb. It explains, everybody always says I blow up at the end of Ironmans. Well, the writing's always on the wall that, I can make it. Why do I do Ironmans that are fast? Because an 8.5 hour day is another 2 liters of sweat.
That's a good point.
Versus an 8 hour day. And I always gravitate towards those shorter races because to me, that 8 hour mark or that about 8 to 8:15, that is a different nutrition plan than 8:30.
That's fascinating. Well, it's really similar to we had a guy in the 80s, Scott Molina, and he could win anything. World's toughest, all these long distance races, short, it didn't matter until he came to Kona. And the whole thing for him was that, when he trained with Scott Tinley here in San Diego, they'd finish a run and Molina would be wringing out his shirt and Tinley would have a little spot of sweat, right? And so he had to, when he finally won in 88, he spent, I think, a month out in Palm Springs just doing all these long rides and figuring out the salt content that he needed to get through that race. He actually, I remember interviewing him and I said, so what was your training like in Palm Springs? He said, I'd like to tell you, but I'd like you to think that I'm a fairly intelligent human being. And I really didn't do a lot of intelligent things out there, but I had to find out how could I handle the heat. And he ran a 3:02 marathon, which helped him win the race. which he never could have done before. So how have you changed? Obviously, you learn you need more, but is it specific? Is it more salt? Is it what else do you need besides just fluid?
You know, I mean, when I showed up there, and I kind of they say, okay, set up your bottles how you normally do, and they were actually shocked at how close my bottle setup was that I raced on, and with basically two scoops of base hydro and one scoop of base salt per bottle.
Mm-hmm.
How close that was to what I exactly needed. So I mean, just there isn't much to change or to tweak. It's a matter of making sure I get that volume in the whole time and consistently, because I mean, I was underhydrating on the run for sure. Everybody wants to run, you know, you want to fly through the aid stations and, you know, grab what you can and just, you know, but I'm going to have to be a lot more surgical and making sure I get the nutrition in, because especially early in the day, it's a little bit cooler before the heat starts radiating off the pavement. So even in the early miles of the bike, you know, it's going to be on the forefront of my mind, as much as, you know, keeping a high pace is fueling for the end of the race.
So it's interesting when I was interviewing Sebastian Kienle and said, what conditions work best for you in Kona to potentially win? He says, I need it hard. I need it blowing. You know, I need to be windy. I need to be tough on everybody else. And to a certain degree, is it the same for you? Because you really want the other guys to have to work hard, but at the same time, you have to be cautious of how much, you know, how long the race goes. If it's a faster condition, seem like it suits you better.
Yeah, faster conditions would definitely suit me better. But at the same time, you know, with the Ironman rules, the way that they're enforced,
right?
Not the way that they're written, it doesn't suit me well. What will suit me the best is the day where it's 50 mile an hour crosswinds the entire day.
Exactly.
So it is impossible to draft. You know, in today's day and age, with all this technology we have, I really wish that we could use it. And basically, you know, when somebody enters a draft zone, we all know it. I mean, you can see what that distance is. You know, using all these sensors that are available, but we choose to stagnate.
Right. It's interesting. So a race like that Chamarin race with a 20-meter draft rule, that's something that you would like. Like that race, that challenge.
I think 20 meters would be great. But it's just not realistic,
right,
on with the current roads that are being used at a world championship at Hawaii. I mean, if instead of us going back into town through the hot corner and going up the Kuakini Highway and then back out to the – if we eliminate that part and we go straight on to the Queen K.
Which we used to do.
I think it would be a more fair race, because – You immediately could get the officials there breaking up the draft back. But basically, because the officials aren't allowed on the Kuakini Highway, that everybody has a chance for the first 15 miles to get their stuff straightened out, and they're free to draft that whole first 15 miles.
You know, it's interesting, because over the years I've seen, you know, Tim DeBoom and Freddie Van Leerd and, you know, some of our better cyclists get popped for blocking or something right in before the airport. I've always felt like, you know what, let these guys sort things out for a while and then jump in and force a drafting. Because I always hate to see ticky-tack stuff early. But I do agree that when you went straight up Palani and hung a left on the Queen Highway, you can, you know, people can sort themselves out very quickly without having sort of the convoluted thing around town and up Kuakini and back and all that type of stuff.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, they give us the course. That's what the course is. And,
right.
That's what we race to.
From your perspective, when you're out there on the bike, is there a, a number of folks you want to be racing with, you know, in terms of your pack, 3, 4, 5 guys, or does it matter?
Yeah, it's a foreign thing for me most of the time when I race with anybody.
Exactly. I know. You're by yourself. Yes. So you're pretty much, if you're, and Kona is really one of the few places where there's a chance that there's somebody going to be with you, right? I mean, that's, when we look at Kona and we talk about the heat and the wind, that's great. But the level of competition is so different. It's so much deeper that, you know, I mean, right. You'll probably have a Josh Amberger. You'll probably have some of the other really good swimmers out there with you early on in that bike ride.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I mean, I think Ironman, it's a world championship. So everybody brings their A game and everybody's willing to roll the dice to be a world champion. And over the years, we've seen quite a few upsets of guys that weren't even on our radar
right. That
go out and win the race just because they have that spectacular day. And, so everybody's willing to go out there. Everybody's willing to roll the dice. A lot of us are willing to roll the dice
mm-hmm.
for that shot to win and willing to blow up and finish 20, 25th place. But, you know, we got to put ourselves in a position to win the race to ever have a chance.
So is this a family trip? We'd be bringing Xander and
yep.
your little girl and everything. So everybody's coming.
Yes. I'm going to get over there a little earlier than them. So, the place is somewhat in order.
Yeah.
When they arrive, but they're gonna come. My daughter's already telling everybody that she's going to Hawaii. So
play with the turtles. Yes, she will love
yeah,
it.
Yeah. So she's really excited, and I mean it's always fun having them at races. And now that I've won a race that they've gone to, now I have confidence that I can actually win a race because it seems like every race they go to, I'd finish like third or fourth. This spring in Chattanooga, you know, having them there and finally winning a race where they're there, it was like, I knew I could do it.
And not only that, did your daughter race the Iron Kids in Chattanooga?
Yeah, she did the Iron Kids. It was, I didn't think she'd run the whole entire way. I mean, it was a half mile and she's 3.
Yeah.
And she was like 3 and 2 months, so she was very young, a 3. And about 2/3 of the way through, she was started to walk, which I was perfectly fine with. I started walking with her. And then a boy passed her, a little
oh,
boy.
Oh, that
and
turned, yeah.
And she got this face. Like, I'm like, oh, I know that look.
You saw yourself, huh?
Yeah.
That's cool. She wanted to chick him. She didn't want some boy
yeah,
going by
he ended
her.
Up beating her, but he ended up beating her. But it definitely got her, like, you know, hey, it's okay to walk, sweetheart. It's, you know, you're really young. This is a really long way.
Yeah.
And at that point, she saw a little boy doing it, and she's like, I'm not getting out done.
So how important was Xander in terms of your recovery from, you know, getting run over by a truck, and just in terms of the motivation he provided for you?
It was, I mean, as much as it was him, it was living in a PICU for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though during that time, I'm either in a wheelchair or I'm on crutches, I'm in a leg brace, I am in a back brace, and as much as, you know, I'm going through, I mean, had Alexander not had any complications or had we not had a kid during that time, you know, I would have been sitting on the couch being poor me, like most people would have. Like,
of course.
Why the heck did I get run over by a truck? But you see there and you see these kids going through things that they never asked to have to go through.
Right.
I would say, I'm not going to say it's motivational, but it's humbling.
No question about it.
You know, I mean, they don't know anything different.
No.
And, it's, I don't know. I mean, a PICU is not a very social place.
No.
Everybody's in there and it's a scary place. I mean,
no question
you know,
about
one,
it.
One day, I mean, it doesn't matter how old they are. I mean, one day your kid's healthy, the next day you're living in an ICU with your hands up trying to figure out what's going on.
Now, when did you know, after your deal with wheelchair, deal with back brace, deal with all this stuff, when did you know or have a feel that you'd be okay, that you'd be able to race again?
It's probably March.
Okay.
I mean, because, yeah, it was one of those words, what can I do today? That's truly what it was, every day. I say it, and people don't comprehend that that is what it was. It was, can I walk? Can I walk without a limp? Okay, I can walk without a limp. I mean, and one of the things for therapy was, is we want you to spin on a bike.
You can do that.
Yeah, I'm like, okay. So I'm sitting there on the kicker and just spinning. And I'm like, so how much power can I put out? They're like, power? We want you just to spin. Well, they're like, I don't know. How about 80 watts? I'm like, 80 watts. I don't speak that language. It's like,
if it's not triple digits, I'm not wasting my time.
Right, right. And so I'm, we just started out and played with it. And one of the other things that they said was, of course I asked, 600 questions. They're like, okay, we want you to, you think you can, start spinning on a bike. You can't lean forward because, I still had to be in my back brace. And it was, okay, I can spin on the bike. Okay, how they want you to go, 20 minutes. Okay, how many times a day? And, three? Okay. 20 minutes, three times a day. And, over the course of 2 months, it grew, or 3 months, it grew to, 90 minutes, three times a day. Which, you do a 90-minute bike ride, granted, it was super easy. I think my heart rate was under 100, but you're doing three 90-minute, you're on the bike 4.5 hours a day.
Right.
And then you're in physical therapy three times a week for another 3 hours or 2 hours. And so it was each time it was, okay, what can we do? And, granted, we did have our setbacks. And the other thing was, is people always ask me, oh, how about swimming? Because everybody who has a broken back, they're like, oh, so, you had to be in the water like right away. And I'm like,
you got road rash everywhere.
Well, but it wasn't that. It was my concussion.
Oh.
I would get in the water and I'd get sick, physically sick. And I actually, one of the days that I actually, and I still get it every once in a while from it, but it was Ironman Wisconsin last year. I raced Ironman Wisconsin, and ever since, from about 5 minutes into the swim, my virtual horizon was off the rest of the day. And I didn't get sick in the swim, but I kind of had that like seasickness, and I had that the entire day. And racing with that was, the bike wasn't fun at all.
It's almost like a little vertigo type of thing.
Yeah. Yes, very much so.
Wow.
Very much so. And, it was one of the few times in my life where I was happy to get off the bike and start running.
Wow.
Yeah, I was very happy to get off the bike that day. I was surprised I made it off the bike, in fact, because Ironman Wisconsin is not an easy bike course.
No.
There's a lot of courses that I could have gone out there and with what was going on in my head, I could have easily finished, but that course was a challenge, especially, the first few miles and last few miles, you're on bike paths and going up and around, and it's a two-loop course, and you're passing people going, all sorts of different speeds.
Yeah.
That was a day, I completely fell apart at the end of that one, but I was happy to come home with a fourth place that day.
So what would you be happy with in Kona this year?
I'm only happy when I win, truly.
I know. You're one of those. You're the Ricky Bobby, right? If you're not first, you're last.
Yeah, I am. Truly. I mean, that's the only thing I'd be happy with is winning.
Gotcha. Yeah, I totally get it. That's the way you race.
I mean, I'm going to go there. I'm going to give it everything I got. I really wish I could have had the opportunity to race there last year with the weather they had.
Right.
I guess I was winning a race in the continental United States that day.
Exactly.
Or that weekend. So, which I'll take. I really want to win that race. I mean, truly, I think, in 2013, my first time out there, I think if I didn't get sick, I would have had a good shot at about a fourth to a seventh place performance.
Mm-hmm.
In 2014, I injured myself at a little USAT exhibition race that I did, which, don't get me wrong, it was one of those super sprint swim bike runs.
Yep.
Multiple times through, and I just stepped in a manhole cover.
Oh.
That wasn't even.
It was
like 3 inches down, but I torqued my hip there, and from where I was at with my training, where that was my speed day, which it was perfect speed day, but it torqued my hip, and ended up needing surgery. And I knew going in the race that something wasn't right, but I'd been training through it, but had a crappy race there, and didn't finish that year at Kona, and then I was looking forward to coming back in,
what was that, 2016. Yep.
2015, I took a break from Kona. I just made a decision that I'd rather race Roth that year.
Right. And what'd you think of Roth? How special is that?
I loved it.
That's such a cool. That's
I
what our,
I
yeah.
I didn't have the day I wanted to. I was so jet lagged for some reason. I mean, I showed up there, I think I was there 5 days before the race, and it was the first time where I ever just battled jet lag. And I showed up to the race and was like exhausted. And that was truly, I mean, it was one of those, I finished at Roth and flew home. And the next weekend I finished, I think, third to Lionel Sanders and Matt Charbeau at Racine the next weekend. So, I mean, I had the fitness. I was just jet lagged. And I mean, coming home, I felt fine. I was wide awake when I came home. So,
then
I was looking forward in 2016. I was in great shape and everything was coming around. And then I got hit.
Right.
And so 16 and 17 were just, just being back to Kona is really.
That's going to be special.
Earning my way back has been just an incredible journey. Going to Wisconsin last year, which is a race that I swore I'd never do.
Why?
And
because
it's right in my backyard, but everything about that course doesn't suit me well. I'm a rhythm rider.
Right. Yep. You are.
I'm a rhythm rider, and there is no rhythm to that course. If that was a symphony, that course, it would sound horrible. I mean, you're on the gas, off the gas, on the gas, off the gas. I mean, it's just, there's no rhythm anywhere in the course.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't suit me well. And then the run course is...
it's hard.
Yeah, it's a harder run course. It's hot and humid, which kind of suits me well. It's not an easy run course either. And there's a lot of Ironman courses out there that suit me a lot better. And I choose to try to race those, but, the timing and everything, it lined up that this year or last year it was a men's pro race. And so I did it. And, I had a lot of fun with it. And I just had, with it being so close to Chicago and so many people from the Chicagoland area there, it was awesome. Everywhere it was, people just, for me, it felt like, you felt like royalty. I mean, everybody there, I felt was my fan, which was really, really cool.
So the rest of the season is a build to Kona?
I'm going to do Kona, and then I'll do Waco 2 weeks afterwards. I'm looking forward to going down and, you know, visiting Central Texas. I always enjoy racing in Texas. Had a lot of success, you know, between Austin and Galveston, Ironman, Texas. So, you know, I enjoy racing in Texas. I mean, even up in Dallas when they had the U.S. Open Triathlon there, I had, you know, success there. So I always just love racing in Texas. And then we'll see from there. You know, if I have a good race in Kona, and I might call it a year. And then I'll take a few weeks off, and then I'll probably start up my season with Challenge Daytona in December.
Very cool. Now, did you break the 4-hour barrier this year?
Yeah. Yes.
Was that
and
Texas?
And regardless of whether the course, you know, the course was slightly short. I mean, it was longer than Roth. It was longer than Austria, but it was short. But, you know, either way, even if it was 112.5 miles, I would have been under 4 hours.
Very cool. That's pretty special when you start going under. How, on a good day, how fast can you do the Kona course, you think?
I mean, I don't know. Hopefully on race day, it's going to take me over 5 hours because the winds are going to be up.
So you do want it hard. Absolutely.
Yeah,
crosswinds.
I want the winds to be up. I'd rather have an honest race than a fast race.
Gotcha.
Because a fast race, I know the rules aren't going to be enforced to the T. So I'd rather have an honest race than a fast race.
Andrew, you are always the best. I'm really glad that you've come out the other side of all this. Just, you know. Now, hey, was it a hit and run? Did the guy stop who hit you?
He tried to flee, but a guy in a crotch rocket saw it happen and turned around, and the driver noticed that he wasn't going to outrun a crotch rocket with a pickup truck.
So then he pretended, I didn't know.
So, yeah, he did return to the scene.
Wow. In jail? Did he get arrested, hopefully?
He served a couple weeks.
Wow. That is scary out there. And now, a lot of the guys, they'll take, you know, they'll go to training camps in Kona and that type of thing. Is that something that, as a you know, father of two, that's probably pretty hard to do, to leave town?
Yeah, I mean, my training consists of pulling my kids, it's about 12 miles to where they go to school, and we have a trail that pretty much runs the whole way, so I drag them to school. And, like, I mean, in June, I pulled the trailer for 800 miles.
Did you really?
They weren't in the trailer all 800 miles, but, I'll drag them to where they go to daycare, the 12.5 miles, drop them off, and then continue on my ride.
And keep the trailer on?
Yeah. I mean, I'm on trails the whole entire way. And the nice part is instead of being 21, 22, 23 miles an hour on the trail, I'm 15, 16, 17. So
with an extra weight on the back.
Yeah, whether it's weight on the uphills, it's a parachute on the downhill. So it's, but you know, I mean, it's a lot safer than going 24 miles an hour on a trail where you got kids and you know, people walking their dogs and every other thing in the world.
Love it, Andrew. Thanks so much for taking so much time. I look forward to chatting again in Kona. It's going to be great to have you back. I think it changes the dynamics immensely, having someone like yourself in that group who's going to be one of the first guys out of the water and then pushing the pace on the bike.
Looking forward to throwing caution to the wind.
Andrew Starkiewicz has been our guest. Again, we are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, toughmantri.com, by VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, chase your destiny, by Premium Plus Hyphen Sports, the best travel agent out there, USA-swimrun.com. If you haven't tried a swim run event, get out there and give one a try. By our Challenge Athletes Foundation, we just received a proclamation from the city of San Diego in honor of our 25 years, 23,000 grants sent out, and over $100 million raised. Check us out at challengedathletes.org. And check out any of our interviews on BabbittVille.com or on iTunes. And until next time, remember, endurance lives here.